So with that, setting the context and taking a look at what professional development is geared to do, I'll just briefly overview the presentation tonight. That we'll take a look at the Department of Teaching and Learning, the importance of having high-quality teachers in all of our classrooms, briefly looking at some elements of effective professional development, and within teaching and learning, how we're organized and funded, some brief examples of what it is that we do, and some sketches of our future direction with some materials that are attached that are a little bit small to see in the PowerPoint. And so you have two attachments of an FDE chart and professional development funding. So beginning, what is it that teaching and learning does? Our mission is core to the mission of the district, assuring that every child has the knowledge and skills needed for academic achievement and a successful life. Oops. I clicked the wrong button. How we do that and our purpose is to enhance teacher quality. We focus on the what, that is the content, the substance that goes on in the classroom, and how that is used with expertise, and combining the what and the how, all for the goal of increasing student achievement. Another way of looking at teaching and learning is our function is the research and development arm of the classroom operations to improve teacher quality, always connected with the goal of increasing student achievement. How we go about our work is summarized in a few bullets. That we're out there to make sure that those best practices coming from research, other school districts, that we are able to bring these into the district, that our teachers have the best materials, best practices. We develop materials to support the best practices. And then to ensure that our teachers are able to use these, provide professional development, support them as they're working to implement these materials and practices in the classroom, and constantly monitor whether we're being effective, primarily by looking at gains in student achievement to know where to pinpoint and to continue working in professional development. So the link then of professional development to student learning. Why are they critical? It's obvious that highly skilled teachers are much more capable of making learning increases and inspiring greater ability to want to learn in teachers, in their students. Highly skilled teachers do make a difference. It's one of the most critical variables. Materials are important, instructional strategies are important, but it's within the package of the teacher and that content knowledge and classroom application of how well this is put together is a very strong predictor of student achievement. What do we know about effective professional development? And with the lens of that kind of professional development experience that's geared towards improving student achievement. This is a summary of some of the main tenets of professional development that is known to directly impact positively student achievement. And beginning by having a focus that will increase content knowledge, a deep content knowledge of the subject areas taught. So focusing on content expertise. Connecting the theory of how it's supposed to work with the realities of the classroom. Making the experiences in the professional development exercises relevant to the classroom, and reflective, so that teachers can begin to internalize what is needed and what that would look like in their own classroom. We also know that one person alone is not going to have the impact for student achievement, as when in groups work together, grade levels, or entire buildings together. So participating in the learning and learning from and with each other is an effective means of professional development. It's not a one-shot deal. Learning takes place over time and of a long duration. It takes several years to truly gain classroom expertise when changing practices or strategies. And an umbrella over all of this is that the goals of the professional development need to be aligned so that it all comes together in a cohesive package towards the goals of the district and the Wisconsin Model Academic Standards, for example, in Wisconsin. So keeping these things in mind, teaching and learning works to provide professional development to increase teacher quality. How are we organized and funded? This is one of those micro views of the handouts that you have towards the end of the packet, where you can see that our FTEs are representing the various content areas, where we have coordinators who generally oversee a large domain of a content area, supported by what we call instructional resource teachers. These are experienced, seasoned classroom teachers with deep content knowledge that are now working to teach other teachers. And the FTEs are dispersed to support the goals of the district and our priorities in literacy and mathematics. You can also see that the funding comes from a variety of sources, in particular the summaries of those are that 60% of our FTEs are funded on the operating budget, roughly 30% from grants, competitive grants, and also entitlements. Title 2A, for example, which is geared towards literacy and mathematics and to provide enrichment and build teacher quality. And Fund 80 supports approximately 10%, 13%. And those are positions that serve not only portions of the district but also community services as well. Another look at how we are funded to actually deliver the professional development. The substitute teachers are one vehicle so that teachers can actually have release time and attend professional development in what we call face-to-face. And so these are the figures from this current year that were dedicated to substitute teachers in the content areas. Extended employment is another form of release so that teachers can receive after-hours professional development. And the sum total of that from our entire teaching and learning budget is about 4%. The remaining portions of the teaching and learning budget are to those who develop, research, and provide the professional development. So what is it that we do then about our work to increase teacher quality? I'd like to share just a few brief examples highlighting each of those areas as I outlined earlier, describing the main functions of teaching and learning. So an example of professional development that has researched best practices, bringing those into the district, are our literacy instruction. The literacy instruction that we work with teachers to provide consistent and high-quality instruction is based on 10 of the best literacy practices that we know of. And these include reading for authentic purposes, and having high-quality literature always available, reading from multiple texts, and allowing plenty of time to read as some of the examples. And so these consistent instructions are known to increase student achievement when they're consistently applied in all classrooms and made available for all students. We also support the instruction with Doyle and building-based coaches to connect the instruction with the classroom implementation. We've assembled the key elements of the literacy instruction at the various grade levels, primary, intermediate, and 6-8 notebooks, which pull together the practices and strategies for teachers and serve as a core for what our literacy instruction looks like within the Madison District. Another example of developing materials, I'd like to talk a little bit about the learning mathematics in the primary grades. And this is a document that really defines math learning for our K-2 students. And I do have a copy of the actual text. And I'll pass that around if you'd like to take a look. There's 10 chapters in there. And they outline the standards and the learning cycle. They talk about the importance of assessment and provide many examples for implementing effective assessments and what to do when students are struggling in particular areas. So it does define very research-based, high-quality instruction in a consistent way for all primary teachers. And again, the materials are supported by Doyle and building-based coaches. The book also outlines intervention strategies for when students are not performing, how to define where those skills are that they're lacking, and how to provide them the support so that they can be successful. It's not just a binder, but this is then an example of the focus for professional development so that teachers are able to become knowledgeable with these resources, become comfortable and confident with using them and implementing them, again, with support from the coaches, both building-based and Doyle. We're currently in the process of drafting the 3.5 version of this, which will be the companion, so that K-5 mathematics instruction will have the parameters and the guidance laid out by next year. Another example of the professional development that follows the guidelines of high-quality professional development for increasing student achievement, I'd like to just talk briefly about freshman science leadership. This is an example of long-term professional development that has been in existence for about 3 years. We've got a pretty consistent core group. And these are teams of teachers representing each of our high schools, including science teachers, ESL, and special ed support teachers, with support from various partnerships, in particular the UW and the SCALE grant. These teams of teachers are looking at research, they're looking at exemplars of best practice, and deepening their science content knowledge as they're applying that to curriculum that will meet the needs of a wide variety of students. Another example of what it is to provide support as teachers are in the classroom working with new materials, an example being our Middle School Math Leadership Academy. Again, this is a long-term professional development experience. Core groups from all of the middle schools have been attending. several times a year. They focus on developing leadership skills around math and developing curricular exemplars and problem solving in those areas that they have seen in their classroom and from their colleagues, and sharing those with their colleagues back at their classroom. Another example of effective professional development is to make sure that you are evaluating whether it's effective or not. And an example being the ongoing evaluation and monitoring of how our students are reading at the third grade level, a board goal. We have consistent instructional approaches, as I've referenced early, with our literacy notebooks. And our staff work with teachers in the building to continually analyze assessment results in depth to know what that next level of instruction is, student by student and building by building. The data is worked into and accounted for in the next steps of school improvement plans, and we have continually demonstrated growth in student achievement as all of these facets have come together in an effective plan. So looking to the future, how will we continue to support and develop highly skilled teachers? Currently, our model is working with individuals and groups of teachers, including coaches, to develop content knowledge primarily in delivery models that are requiring face-to-face, that is, release time. We develop classroom expertise through coaches, and there are increasing numbers of coaches in the building. They're building-based and building-supported, and we have resource teachers who also play the role of building-based coach. And we offer a wide variety of professional development opportunities. Looking to the future, what are the changes, hanging on to those aspects that are effective and trying to move towards being more effective in diminishing resources? We certainly want to amplify and magnify the ability of building-based coaches and learning coordinators, as this is truly an effective model to have a site-specific person be able to coordinate and facilitate the learning at a particular building. Content knowledge acquisition, moving from the face-to-face to offering aspects of professional development where appropriate through online, which offers a variety of advantages, including flexibility of time in a busy day and age. We want to increase the classroom expertise through trying to leverage additional coaches and supporting those coaches to become leaders within their buildings. And we would focus intensive support to the coaches at the elementary and the middle schools. We want to focus the professional development on those aspects that are core to the practices and the goals of Madison, and certainly to continually increase assessment strategies to fine-tune that circle and feedback loop to make sure that it's directed in the areas of most need. A schematic way of looking at the shift towards the future, which does include instructional coaches and online courses, how they would play together would be that professional development would be delivered through both modes, teaching and learning, designing online courses, and offering and facilitating those directly with teachers, but also working with coaches so that they can facilitate and encourage learning at their building and having access and knowledge of the availability of online courses. So the knowledge acquisition through online courses and the classroom applications heightened through the instructional coaches, which play together to develop highly skilled teachers for successful students for the future in a more cost-effective way. So these changes will result in effective professional development and developing a culture of ongoing learning with the availability of online courses facilitated with coaches. We believe that the courses would be able to actually reach more teachers and provide an opportunity for consistent access and not be limited to individuals in face-to-face through substitute teachers. Some of the advantages of online also include flexibility, repeatability, being able to have the opportunity to control the pace and time of learning. We'd be increasing building-based leadership and provide a more equitable use of district resources. So the system that works together for instructional support is extensive, and teaching and learning plays a role in that with many departments and divisions. Working directly under the superintendent and assistant superintendents, aspects of teaching and learning to provide professional development is partnering with educational services, the technical hardware components with tech services, partnering with government programs in working towards effective use of entitlement grants and also the new teacher support. Media services is very important as we look at producing more of our courses online. Human resources, working through many of the issues of teacher credits. Research and evaluation becomes even more critical as we're looking at increasing the role of assessment in student learning as it affects professional development. And certainly student services also has many roles in professional development. And so these models work together as a system that wraps around the schools and teachers to provide them a package of professional development that's more cohesive as we work even more collaboratively together. The goal being highly skilled teachers for all students to make sure that the broad mission of our district becomes a reality. And this is the last video here. So as we're building the confidence and the competence of teachers through professional development, we know that it's critical for ensuring all students have excellent teachers, because it's our teachers that are the ones that touch the students, our future. So, thank you, and be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Ms. Robarts?
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to see that one of the components of this whole presentation is the discussion, to some extent, of in-depth assessment analysis, evaluating effectiveness by measuring gains, and so forth. But I'm wondering if you could tell me a little more about, take an area like math. I have seen the kind of information about math tests that's on DPI, and I've seen some stuff internally that's at the absolute micro level. You know, particular school, standard A, 3-7-B, you know, and so forth and so on. But what I don't understand is what kinds of data are you using in the math area, let's take elementary math, to look for these kinds of things? Is it effective? Are students making the kinds of gains? What's the level of data that you use to inform the rest of this process?
There are certainly the broad levels and measures that you have seen. We have the WKCE scores, which are now at 3 through. We have the primary math assessment, which is reported out on report cards in the fall, and teachers are encouraged to reassess as there are needs and see changes in their students. So those are the student and programmatic level of data that we have to continually monitoring how particular children are, looking at building overall composites. And the work that the instructional resource teachers are able to do is to continually look at the student data, both classroom level and more formalized data, and to work closely with the principals in analyzing that data in the development of school improvement plans is one of the
When they look at the more formalized data, do they look at the, I think it's five different sets of standards that make up the math standards. Do they look at those separately as well as in the aggregate?
Certainly. An item analysis, which is an in-depth look at, and now I think that you're probably talking about the WKCE, an effective way to look at the strands within the WKCE is to do an item analysis and having the actual test, the secured test, with groups of teachers to look at the performance of the children either individually or an entire grade level within a building and analyze what about that particular question and that standard and the opportunity to learn that standard.
So this is at the level of under, say, algebraic reasoning,
certainly,
standard one, ABC.
Right, and to a particular question to see about the level of content depth that was required of that, how it was phrased. And these are some of the most effective ways of really analyzing how students are performing on tests, connecting it with instruction, and what might be changed or remedied about
it. It's actually even one level lower than the stuff we gave you, that we showed
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering in terms of sort of mine and I think the board's longstanding interest in something like ninth grade algebra. You know, if you're learning things from this analysis that are, I mean, I hope they're helpful in training teachers to teach better, but I'm wondering if you're using information in that kind of level in order to fine-tune your program, why is it so hard for us to get data that would tell us district-wide or grade-level-wide how kids are doing in the five main areas at different grade levels? Why is that so hard to get?
I believe that data is being...
Yeah, we can do that. One of the issues with it, it's easy to report it and fairly effective to report it 1 year comparing to, let's say, the district average or the state average. At the strand level, the particular questions from year to year within that strand have different levels of difficulty. The levels of difficulty of the questions across math, for example, when you get a math score, the broad math score, those are the same from year to year.
I thought we'd come to an agreement that we weren't going to try and compare 1 year to the other, but we were going to finally get a snapshot that included information about these five strand areas.
And that's what we showed you to say, is this what you're looking for? Is this reporting the way we gave it to you is the way it just comes off? Or is there a better way to format it?
Well, that's what I'm asking. It would seem to me that that's way too detailed to be useful to us or the community in terms of taking a look at even 1 year of results. But it sounds like, you know, you're able to get data that you can use to make choices about which schools, you know, or which levels need coaches and what's a better method. Well, and I'm just wondering, what is that data? Or, you know, what are the magic words that I need to say in order to get that kind of data? I mean, it concerns me greatly in the algebra area that although the numbers of students passing are going up, the difference between white and black students, or the difference between low-income and not low-income students on that next year's test are huge. The white students are passing at about the same level. They're showing up proficient and advanced. These other groups are not. They're passing at much lower rates and are much behind when you look at the 10th grade tests. And I won't drag this out now, but you know, if somebody could tell me what it is I need to ask for, I think it would be helpful, because this sort of, we're building it on data, or our SIP plans are built on data. You know, I believe that. I think you're building it on data. That what mystifies me is why it's not possible to pull up and put that data in some sort of form that the board could analyze.
And we would be more than happy to sit down and show you exactly what we got. And then, because, I mean, what you get, with the exception of getting down to the actual question level, what we gave you was what we use.
And you don't ever summarize it? You just get piles and piles and piles of...
Well, there's a district summary.
Yeah, that would be maybe one step.
I think we can get a district summary across.
So I'm getting a school-specific standards, you know, and I can't believe that that's only form in which people use the data.
And I'm sorry, our understanding was that you wanted it school-based, but we can get the same thing that you've got at the district level that would say, as a district,
here's the
standard.
Well, that would at least be a start. Maybe I could understand. Maybe I could follow up with you later. I'm sorry to take so much time.
You're glad to.
Ms. Avera.
Thanks for your presentation, Lisa. I have a question on your section when you were talking about future directions, and then you had additional online courses and instructional coaches. Mm-hmm. How does that then tie in with your sheet on your staffing right now? If you're going to be adding or doing more instructional coaches and then also more online teaching, how does that affect the structure of your department as it stands today?
The leverage of additional coaches is not necessarily within the Department of Teaching and Learning, that we would be working collaboratively, trying to maximize the use of coaches and at the building level, where our role would be to really intensify our support. If we are, if there are to be more coaches at the building level, then our focus would definitely be at building the content expertise and supporting them in an intensive way. The direct funding of coaches would be a building-based, as it is at this point in time, and we would be focusing on the support of the coaches and on the design and delivery and facilitation of the online courses.
The coaches, for example, and we have, I don't know how many we have right now, but several right now, they actually come down here for training one day a week. They actually come in, work together. They're trained, because you're training them really in three things. You're continually increasing, and first of all, they're expert people to begin with. So you're increasing their content knowledge. You're increasing their knowledge of how to teach this. I know what I'm teaching. How do I teach it? But thirdly, you're increasing their knowledge in terms of how you coach. There's a difference in delivering a staff development course and in providing coaching and ongoing support inside the building by doing model lessons, by observing teachers and giving them feedback, doing those kind of things. So Lisa's people are providing those three kinds of staff development directly to the coaches, who are then doing it broadly across the buildings themselves.
And the coaches are 100% coaches. They don't teach as well, do they?
That's correct. They would be 100% coaches.
And I have one more question on the online training. And actually, it's a question that I've received from some teachers. If teacher training is going to be by online courses, that's going to fit into their typical day? There's not going to be expectations of, you're go home tonight and watch this course type deal, or log in and do it over the weekend.
That would really be up to them. They receive remuneration for this. When they this is not free. When they do either face-to-face or online courses, either one, and it is outside the school day, our expectation during the school day would be that they're using their time to plan their classes.
So it's going to be no different than...
No, no different than it is right now. They receive advancement on the salary schedule which is a significant investment by the district in their skills. They receive advancement on the salary schedule based on taking these courses, just like they do now.
Some courses may also come with credit, and that would also be an incentive. So if it is offered after school, after contract hours, the parameters that we have in place now for professional development would still be in place, that there is either
It's all web-based, so they can do it whenever they want to. They have total flexibility. They can do it whenever they want to.
Ms. Kubza, followed by myself, then Ms. Mathag.
One of the things I'm trying to get a handle on is how time is spent and what people are doing, and so I really appreciate the presentation, but a lot of it was professional development is really important, and we provide professional development. So I really didn't get some of the information that I'm looking for as far as how much time is being spent on different things, just so I have a better understanding of what really goes on and how long things take, because I wouldn't know that. And we have on the chart, we have 52 FTEs, so that kind of gives me an idea. If you go to the presentation on the second page of our handout, the upper left-hand corner, you had a slide on saying teaching and learning work, and then you had a list, I think, of five different things mm-hmm. you do. So maybe that would be a good one to start with. And what I'd like to do, and I don't want to tie you down, but I really just want to get kind of a gut feel of things about how much time, if we said percentage of time, the teaching and learning does on these different things, about how much time it would be for the different things, like researching best practices. If you'd say the department as a whole.
I think that researching best practices is something that we're always doing in an ongoing basis. Conferences, work with other school districts, work with the DPI. These are standing and ongoing. To put a percentage on that would be a little difficult. It depends on the content area and where you might be at a particular spot. But roughly, I would say that might be around 10%. The developing materials is a very, very time intensive. Creating a notebook, as I highlighted several, these are culminations of a year or more worth of effort, not full time, but to get the steps and the processes, and working with teachers to make sure there's reality checks and it's useful is a very long-term and intensive process. Providing the professional development, that varies depending on the mode. Preparing for a day of face-to-face can sometimes take 2 to 3 days to prepare, and that's when you have your materials already set. There's other kinds of professional development that's building leadership, being in buildings. Some of the staff within teaching and learning does play a building-based coach role as well, and that's a significant portion of their time.
Let me just stop you for a minute. If we were to say, because I really want to get kind of a relative feeling, so just saying we spend a lot of time on each different category, would it be easier if we put them in a list of 1 through 5? I mean, I'm just trying to get a relative feel here to say this is the number one amount of time. And
I would say that 2, 3, and 4 compromise the bulk of the time. That is the developing materials, the actual professional development design and delivery, and supporting within the classroom or through website postings, through working with principals to ensure that the implementation would be my rough estimates of how it would play out. And those vary from content area and from year to year. When someone is in a design mode, obviously things shift.
I don't think we're trying to be evasive. It's just
No, I know.
Let me give you an example. The team that's been working on this was probably spending 80% of their time on this. Okay. Now, when this came out, that same team then really moved into professional development mode as opposed to developing this. So they've developed it. They're following up with teaching people how to do it, while another team may be starting on another design.
Okay, let me ask then some questions on that manual. How many people would you say were devoting a majority of their time on working on that manual?
We had at that time four elementary math instructional resource teachers. They worked as teams, as a team, and also then going out into the schools to get information and work with master teachers in their classroom. So that extends the pool, but four people primarily working a large share of their time.
So, and is that 100% unique material created within the district?
They're drawing from research. They're synthesizing many different kinds of research on learning, on effective mathematics instruction, effective assessment, but it is pulled together in a unique way. This is our Madison Metropolitan Primary Math Notebook.
Okay, and here's the last question then.
Let me make a question.
Yeah.
This particular notebook, probably even more than most of the other things we do, is unique in that it is, as far as we know, the only place. One of the things about mathematics instruction is, regardless of what approach you take, there really isn't a mathematics curriculum that addresses all the things in mathematics that you need to address. So mathematics curriculums require that you supplement that material. What makes this one unique, and as far as we know is the only one around, is that it does that for the teacher. So although, for example, if you look at numeracy or computation of numbers, one of the supporting materials is Singapore Math. Well, Singapore Math is a math program that somebody else has. But taking it apart and saying to support this specific strand and this specific type of issue, here's where you take page 48 in chapter 12 of Singapore Math, and it's what does this. That's what was really unique about this.
So is every large school district in the country doing this? Are we recreating the wheel in every school district? I mean, I guess I wonder, I mean, wouldn't every large district need something like this?
As far as we know right now, to my knowledge, this particular notebook is unique.
But we also have then the one we saw, the three for the literacy.
Well, the three literacy notebooks we actually sell. So a lot of people, I think there's about 125 school districts right now that are using our literacy notebook. So in a lot of those places, we really are out on the cutting edge with what we've done. And some of that is our own people, and some of it comes from our relationship with the university. We have access to that stuff quicker than most people do. So most of our work is particularly in the way it's organized and the way it's trained and used, is pretty unique.
I'll let somebody else go.
Okay, just a few questions real quick. And you answered one of them, obviously, like a notebook like that. Is that something that you would sell to another district?
For literacy, that is the case at this point in time. We're not at the final details for this, for the mathematic, learning mathematics in the primary grades. And we are just in the finishing stages of the intermediate version of this. So it is definitely
but we
a
will.
Possibility.
Yes.
Do you know how much money that we garner from that?
Generally is covering the printing costs and the mailing costs.
We sell them for about $25 a copy.
Okay.
I mean, one of the issues we have is that we don't support the materials. So if we had staff, if we provided support like a textbook company would, if we provided that kind of support and follow-up and training and all that kind of stuff, it would be a whole different ballgame. This is my dream. This isn't necessarily everybody else's, but I think as we develop our online courses, if you take our literacy that's now being used by an awful lot of people, As we develop the online courses for our teachers in terms of how to utilize that material, then we can also sell that type of training materials along with our materials, and then it becomes a much more viable way to make some fairly decent money, I think.
Okay. Do you share this information, you know, your notebooks, best practices with the Minority Student Achievement Network? Is that something you have?
We have shared it with them in various presentations. They can buy copies like everybody else. But we do, we do share it in terms of presentations and those kind of things. And we've done a lot of work with them back and forth in a presentation format in the area of literacy, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years.
Is there a scale report this year? Do you know what I'm talking about? I remember it had to be about 2 years ago now. You gave the board from the scale grant, there was a report that was generated. Is that an annual report?
There is an annual report. We just had completed our site visit in November, and to my knowledge, it's not public printed as of yet.
When it does, can the board make sure we get that? And then in terms of, lastly, just state funding and federal funding. Obviously, much was said about our literacy programs, or I should say the federal government's literacy program. Has there been any discussion in trying to recoup some of that loss of those federal dollars at all?
There has been. We've actually written to our congressional delegation. All three of them have said that they will, and they have. We have copies of letters that they've written to the Department of Education. Whether or not anything comes of that remains to be seen. We have not heard anything from those, but other than the Department of Education said they received it and they would look into it. It's a little bit like check is in the mail.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe the check is in the mail.
But no, we have tried to pursue those again.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Mathiak, followed by Ms. Robarts.
I want to continue along the lines that Ms. Kubza was asking, because I confess I'm a little bit confused myself about some of this. And so please bear with me. Am I understanding correctly that these materials that are being developed in teaching and learning are used in Madison primarily?
They're designed designed for Madison and used primarily, although as we've just mentioned, there are other districts that have requested our materials and do rely on
right,
them.
But 100-some districts out of how many in the United States? It's 15,000.
That's
probably,
without marketing.
Yeah.
I understand that we don't market at all.
Yeah, no, I understand. This is, believe me, what I'm trying to figure out is what are the other districts using?
Scale districts, for example, do use many of the resources that we use in mathematics, for example, and also do rely on pulling together a couple of different resources.
Okay, but what about the not scale districts? I'm really not as interested in what happens with in our little math culture. I'm very interested in what happens with the other schools who are not part of that culture.
Generally, they will rely on instruction of a vendor or a text and supplement it as district tradition. And I think that is what is unique about Madison, is that the ability to draw the strengths from a variety of some of the better materials and put them together in a fashion that truly meets the needs of students, trying to direct the professional development at the ability of teachers to know and assess.
I understand. I don't mean to cut you off. It's just it's been a very long night, and to be honest, I've heard your presentation. It's very interesting. But what I'm really interested in is, for example, when we hire math teachers, does that make it how do we integrate new teachers into the system, because they will not have had background in, you know, it's not the same as when you have a standard text.
I think that would be true. That would be true regardless of the whatever particular textbook series or approach or whatever we use. People are going to come a lot of different places. We provide staff development. I mean, that's really what we do, is we expect that most people who come into our school district will need staff development in whatever methodology we're using. That would be true of any school district. There are innumerable different approaches in both literacy and mathematics to teaching those, and each individual school district would adopt one. Some of those, as a matter of fact, I saw one not very long ago in literacy that I had never heard of, is a lady in Georgia who has a program that she's actually suing the federal government over in Reading First, and I'd never even heard of the program, but that doesn't mean I've heard of all of them. There are many, many, many different approaches and programs, some done by commercial vendors that we're familiar with, Houghton Mifflin, Silver Burdett, those kind of programs, some done by individual groups, some done by universities. For example, in mathematics, Connected Math, I think, was done by Michigan State University. So there's a whole lot of different ones out there, all that vary, some greatly from each other, some a little bit from each other. I think in general terms, they're kind of grouped into constructivist kinds of approaches and traditional, for want of a better term, approaches in both literacy and math. So there's a whole range of those programs, including ours. So there's across the 15,000 school districts, there's no telling how many different ones there are that vary a little bit or a whole lot.
But the majority of them are probably using standard materials?
We don't know that. I don't think we have any idea what the breakdown of that is.
Okay. And then a question related to the students, because we're in the process of a high school and middle school redesign so that students can go between our middle schools more easily and our high schools more easily. So what happens to the students who transfer out of district having been through this unique educational program?
I don't think unique is the right term for it. We're teaching the standards, and we're teaching the content, and that's what they're going to take with them wherever they go. If they know how to do a quadratic equation, they're going to know how to do a quadratic equation whether they're in Madison or they're somewhere else. So the particular instructional approach, I don't think, is an issue. What's the issue is that instructional approach, in fact, allowing them to teach the standards, which for all everybody talks about, there's not national standards. If you look at the standards across the United States, state by state by state, they are very, very similar. So the whole idea is how you allow students to learn the standards. So if I know the standard, then I can apply that regardless of what system I go into when I go somewhere else.
I'm resisting the temptation to say that for students they really need the skills, not the standard.
The standards are skills. The standards are both content knowledge and skills. The ability to do process is a major part of the skills. So what kids know and can do is what you're trying to teach. The way you do that can vary greatly, but the final result is what they know and what they can do.
Then I just wanted to ask, and I'm really sorry for taking so much time, but are teachers still required to earn continuing education units?
The Department of Public Instruction does not offer clock hours, if that is what you're referring to. There are two purposes that teachers need to continue to engage in lifelong learning: to renew their license for licensure, and if they wish to move on the pay scale.
Okay, so in order to maintain their license, they do need to take college courses.
Well, that's one option.
Or some form of continuing education.
That's correct.
Yes.
Do our professional development opportunities that you've described this evening fit that continuing education criteria?
all of the professional development, we underwent a process a couple years ago to make sure that it's aligned and identified what the teaching standards are, so that a new teacher who is working on their professional development plan can map out what they need to work on according to the teaching standards. And the professional development, the proposal process takes a look at what will this help you meet.
Yeah, new teachers have to do, teachers who were already certified at a certain level were grandfathered in, and they can still get college credit only, and they don't have to do a professional development plan. New teachers particularly coming in, and teachers who are in the profession can choose to do a professional development plan that they develop, and they have a committee made up of a higher ed rep, an administrator, and another teacher who review that professional development plan. For example, if I'm a first-year teacher, I have 3 years to do that. And that professional development plan can include college courses. It can include our courses if they're appropriate and they fit in, so it can be a mixture of those things. Our courses and college credit both also allow you to advance on the salary schedule. And both can also fit into this professional development plan that you have to develop.
And it would meet the criteria for licensing?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Robarts, followed by Ms. Carstensen.
I have several questions. One of them, Lisa, goes back to Ms. Coves' questions. I think one of the things that you haven't answered is about how much time goes to the evaluation of effectiveness, evaluating effectiveness by measuring gains in student achievement. Overall, you said most of the time goes of teaching and learning goes into developing materials and providing support and so forth. About how much overall goes into evaluation of the effectiveness?
It's not as a significant a portion of the overall time as the other three that I mentioned, but our teachers are continually working with principals in their identifying their needs to continue and move forward with their school improvement plan, particularly around WKCE. When those results come out, we're working with teachers to take a look at the analysis of the test and how they can continue to improve instruction and improve the learning process. We are working during the summer. A lot of time is dedicated towards the development of the SIP plan and how the professional development that particular content areas can offer can help strengthen that. So in a sum total, I would say that perhaps that's a 10%, whereas that would complement the research best practices, which is roughly around 10%.
One of the things that makes this difficult is there's a period of time in the year. I mean, because we're thinking about it over the whole year, but there's a period of time in the year when the WKCE test results come in that they may be spending 90% of their time during that short period of time doing that and not doing a lot the rest of the year. So if you think about it over the course of the whole year, it may be 10%. The same way with research best practices, it may be 10%. If you look at it in a concentrated time, it may be very different.
I understand that. I appreciate that. Thinking about it in terms of overall time, I think it's really one way that I, as a board member, would think about it. I think about, again, more about the math standards in particular haven't changed a great deal, say, in the 10 years I've been on the board. They were some of the first standards and, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they've...
The state standards have not changed, but we have since that time developed grade-level standards.
We've developed grade levels. We've heard for many years about aligning everything and, you know, doing these so that we'd know at the end of the year what kids no one can do, say, in the math area. My feeling is that I've heard many presentations, this is not a comment on yours at all, many presentations that are about a staff development process, whether it's producing unique materials or not, which is fairly time intensive. You know, we're developing the materials ourselves, we're marketing them, we're, you know, some of our scarce teacher dollars go to teachers who teach teachers, teachers who coach teachers, and so forth. That would seem to me to be entirely justifiable if the department or the administration shared with the board and the public what are we seeing in terms of the kids' progress in the standards that makes us feel that's a good idea. I mean, I wholly agree there are a million curriculums, and I, for myself, am unqualified to make any guesses about which might be better than another. But as an elected official, I think, you know, one of the frustrations for me has been to try and find a way to, I mean, perhaps this is the best possible way to do it, but it's difficult to explain to parents and your constituents if you can never point to data. These are data-driven departments, but data that shows that this kind of investment is, in this particular way, is paying off for our kids now. I don't see, I haven't seen, you know, and granted the tests have changed in a variety of ways. There are a lot of those kinds of variables. But in many sectors, I think it's hard to get people to invest in a particular staffing model and staffing approach, which is based on data and based on accountability. And you know, this is the part of it we see. We see the goals, we see the costs, we don't see results, information about results that might lead us to think this is a good investment in math, a bad investment in science, or whatever. We just, I'm not seeing that kind of data. Maybe that's more of a comment than anything else. My other question, though, has to do with some of the funding sources are Title I, Title IIA, Title IIB. If we did not use the money to fund what I think is maybe seven or eight of these positions, in this way, what are the other ways we can use that same kind of money? What's it? What's the scope of what those kinds of funds can be used for?
Title IIA in particular is earmarked for improving teacher quality. Okay. So that is a good match with professional development. That is, in fact, what it is designed
That's what
for.
It is.
One
what about 1 and 2B?
Title IIB is also a competitive grant, which is focused at improving teacher quality, and that is its design and purpose.
In Title I?
Title I.
Can be used in the classroom in a variety of places.
Yes, you mean. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
If I can make just one comment, I think regardless of the curriculum that we used and the approach we used, you would still staff develop it the same way. I mean, you would still, regardless of which approach you use in terms of delivering instruction, that you would still have the same staff development structure for teachers to learn how to do that, because there aren't any of them with your like innate knowledge. So you would provide that same, that part of it would be the same whether we were using something we developed or something we got from Houghton Mifflin. We would still do the same kind of training around it, I think. So that's somewhat divorced from what you're actually teaching, I think.
Ms. Costison, followed by Ms. Kubza, followed by Ms. Mathiak.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that I particularly value about this district is the investment we've been willing to make in professional development. And as I talk to teachers, as I visit schools, that is one of the things that I hear from teachers is the extent to which they appreciate having the support, the backup of people that they can work with, who've worked with them, who help them create the groups at the school, the grade level teams or the broader, the subject area teams, to work together. And going back to ancient history, when I started teaching, And of course, I. Right, yeah, right. There was fighting. Right. Not very good illumination, though. Admittedly, I was a social studies teacher, which is a little beside what we're talking about, but I think this was true in a lot of areas. You were handed a curriculum guide, and you were handed a textbook and a grade list and told where your classes meet, and at least in one system that I taught in, you were handed two reams of paper, and that was all you were supposed to use all year, and that was it, and you were on your own. And occasionally the principal came by and sat in on your class, and if they didn't, you know, at least one of the principals, I remember, liked all the shades to be at the same level, and that was the only thing he ever commented about. And you were pretty much thrown on your own resources. And having dealt with a number of different textbooks on particularly American history, no textbook worked well. And finally, a group of people that I, at the school I was teaching at, got together and we began to write our own materials, because there were certain things that we felt we ought to be doing or getting at, and the textbook wasn't responsive to what we thought as important. And you know, writing your own materials, and even when we just would refer to, you read this chapter here or something else, takes a lot of time. And I've certainly heard from teachers in our system who really appreciate the literacy in notebook. In fact, the point at which somebody was talking about that, they were saying, gee, I wish they would do that for math, because I found it so valuable in terms of helping me structure my classes. I think this was about 2 years ago, before the math notebooks were out. And I really think that the reason we have been doing so well with our students, and I guess I would differ with some of my colleagues, I think that a number of the things that I look at have indicated that we are improving our ability of our students to perform well in a variety of ways, has its origins in the time and effort we've invested in staff development, and particularly moving from the, you know, this is the right way to do it and I'm going to tell you all about it, to the coaching model, which, as I understand, is having a person right there in the school to work with individual teachers or groups of teachers on how you approach things. And I think that has been had a significant role in bringing the district together around curriculum and in making sure that our teachers really are well trained.
Just want board members to be conscious of the time. I know everyone here has professional commitments tomorrow, particularly in the morning and things. And so, I heard that in our executive session. So I just want to be very conscious of that. We do have another, what I would maybe consider a lengthy agenda item, and maybe not. But a couple more people would like to speak. Ms. Kubza, Ms. Mathiak, Ms. Rivera would like to speak, and Ms. Kubza.
In all my comments tonight, our questions are really just to understand things better. That's it. So if I look at the list of the FTEs, and what we were talking about before as far as researching best practices and developing materials, would it be fair to say that those, especially with regard to the developing of materials, that is really the people in reading, language arts, and mathematics, that the other areas are not doing developing materials, or are they?
Certainly, science and talented and gifted have been developing materials and courses, library media services.
No, just a second. When you talk about developing materials and courses, are we talking about materials like a binder that go out to everyone, or are we talking about developing a professional development course that they then go out and present?
Both. For example, science over the past couple years has been working in tandem with the Department of Public Instruction in developing actual grade level standards, which is one of the first steps to be able to move forward in knowing where students are at and how to move them to the next level. And so that's a development, not necessarily of materials, but of instruments and tools that are critical for discussing progress in student learning. Our library media services do also design and present professional development, looking at quality literature, looking at the research that's out there on how to access materials and the kinds of systems that are going to be effective and cost-effective for our district and our librarians. So we do a wide variety of services depending upon what that content is and where they might be.
So for our teachers then, when we're providing professional development for them, is teaching and learning providing 100% of the professional development for our teachers?
I would not say 100%. There are some building-based groups and study groups. We often facilitate and launch those, provide the materials to make them effective. And then there's also professional development within the other departments as well. Ed services and special ed also provide support for teachers of different natures.
Okay. And then when a professional development class is held, is someone from teaching and learning the presenter, or do we bring in outside presenters for that?
Again, that's going to depend. For the vast majority of what we do with professional development, we do rely on our teaching and learning staff, to some degree our partners, and you've had presentations on those. But there are cases in which an outside consultant is brought in. An example of that would be the launching into literacy as we're working with the preschools and connecting them with our kindergartens. We've organized, facilitate, set the goals, but there are then consultants that provide some.
Another example would be
that.
Right.
That's good. I mean, I'm just I'm really trying to just
yeah,
look
no,
at the very,
very small percentage of people would come in from the outside. Mm-hmm. And generally would be on a grant, the comprehensive school reform grants, for example, where a school decided to be a professional learning community, and there may be somebody who does that, their grant was written to bring those people in to create this. But 99% our people provide.
And then as far as teaching and learning staff being out in the schools, assisting with coaching or evaluation, what percentage of their time would you say is spent on that, or how often are they out in the schools?
Well, I'm not trying to be evasive, but you can see that there are different numbers of staff at different mm-hmm. content areas, and so that's going to be one of the deciding factors. If you have multiple people, you're often going to be able to specialize at individual grade levels, and in those levels, particularly mathematics and literacy, you're going to be able to provide more building-based support.
How much time?
Let's say mathematics. How much time would the staff from the mathematics be in the school buildings?
During this year, without a good deal of our substitute funds, a very high percentage. Like what? 75%?
And that's partly because they're done with writing the material, or they're not done writing the material and they're spending the other 25?
Well, that's just the 3-5, and there's only a couple people that are dedicated at 3-5.
All
so
right.
We have middle and high and primary working in the schools.
Okay, and then let's say reading. What would you say for reading?
reading is configured a little bit differently, and at this point in time, they are working on the development of materials at the 3-5 as well. Actually, in the schools, probably 35% to 50%.
Okay. All right, then. Thank you, Lisa.
Ms. Mathiak, followed by Ms. Rivera.
I really appreciate the questions and the thoughtful discussion here, because this is a very interesting area indeed. I think, just so you have a sense of where I'm coming from, I see two different sets of questions in my own mind. One relates to professional development, which I think is, I don't think anybody would argue that that's a bad thing, that it's not in our best interest to devote resources to professional development. The other I'm a little more ambivalent about, as you may have guessed from my earlier questions, and that is the issue of devoting time to development of curricular materials. What I'm not getting a sense of from all of this discussion is, when I think about professional development, it seems to me that there are lots of ways that it can happen. As you've said, there's professional development that is designed and provided by teaching and learning. We have building-based groups. I believe the Ed School has some initiatives where it works directly with a small number of our schools. We have programs like Launching Into Literacy. Then we have the credits that teachers and staff take as part of ongoing CEU, continuing education units, whatever you want to call it, and so forth and so on, perhaps some in-services, some other things. And then we've got the coaches and the coaches for the coaches. So what I would love to see at some point is something that, and this is more directed at the superintendent because this falls outside of just teaching and learning, but I would like to get a holistic picture of what it is that we're really bringing to bear on our district in terms of professional development at the different levels, because it seems to me that we've got a lot going on. I would find it very helpful to get a sense of how it all works together and what it means both in terms of the people and the resources, and then back to that basic question of what results are we seeing. So it's sort of more directed to you because it's bigger than Ms. Wattel.
Ms. Rivera?
I'm going to pass. Most of my questions were asked by Lori, and okay. I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Vang? Thank you.
Well, thank you for the presentation. When I leave the board, I will leave with some memories, and one of those is from the superintendent who I think has, over the years that I've been here, stated that the district is where we are because of our ability to serve kids on a teacher-student ratio. And also the level of support that we give our teachers in the classroom by way of professional development. And I assume that this, you said 15,000 districts in the United States, and each and every one of them, one way or another, have a professional development department, or for some of the smaller staff districts, staff who supports teachers in the classrooms, regardless of the approach. I wanted to ask you, the total FTEs that we have right now for the teaching and learning department for this year is 52.25 or 0.27. 5 years ago, what was that number at?
I honestly don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. I assume that with each budget cycle that we go through. Is this a department that the FTE has remained the same, or have we eliminated a lot of positions over the years?
This is really off the top of my head. My sense is we have, it's probably about the same, or we've eliminated a little bit. We have not we've moved stuff onto grants. Some of these positions are maybe on a competitive grant and are passing through. But I think the operating budget positions and the one that are on entitlement grants are probably fairly consistent. What we have cut here is administrative positions that we have cut. There was a time that we had both a science coordinator and an environmental ed coordinator, for example. There was a time that we had a physical education coordinator, physical education and health. Okay. There was a time that we had a social studies coordinator. I think the instructional resource teacher is probably relatively similar to what it was. It may be down a little bit, but the major hit here has been in administration.
Okay. So we have, in many ways, tried to protect those who work directly with classroom teachers.
It is certainly, this and class size have been our two things that we've tried to protect. As I told the board several years ago when we first started talking about this, that in my mind, that the best possible situation is small class sizes and highly skilled, highly trained teachers. That's as good as it gets. The second as good as it gets is highly trained, highly skilled teachers in big classrooms, not the reverse. So based on that, we've tried to protect those two things to the extent that we possibly can. So we have protected here.
And then I guess questions about approach and the outcomes are arguable. I mean, each district would have different approach to using the staff that are allocated to give support in the classrooms. And I don't know if there is a right way or a wrong way to do that. But
well, we obviously believe our way is the right way, but that's that's probably a very biased judgment.
Yeah, that I would agree with that. I don't know if Oregon and Middleton would agree with that. But so I won't be around, but you know, I do support the approach that classrooms, smaller size ratio, student-teacher classrooms, and providing support to our teachers are probably two very important things that we do in this district to give our students the best opportunity when they come to school every day. So thank you for the presentation.
Ms. Wolfman, I'm not sure that our structure is very different to other school districts of our size. We may use them a little bit differently, but I think probably the way, in terms of having instructional resource teachers, content specific, and those kind of things, I think is relatively, would be pretty much the same in school districts of our size. Obviously, when you get into smaller school districts, they don't have any staff doing this hardly at all. But that, for our size, we're probably fairly typical.
Okay. Just a couple quick housekeeping, or I should say more calendar issues. Next week, we'll be talking about special education services. So, obviously, Jack Jurgensen will be in front of us. And
they also have a staff development component of their own that's separate to this.
Okay. And on March 5th, the alternative programs and student services we'll be talking about. So just to give people some heads up on what's coming up on the agenda. We'll move on to the next item on our agenda. Thank you, Ms. Wachtel. We appreciate your time, effort, and energy. And your